From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made every day, week, and month in our community. This hour, we're talking about poverty, but not just talking. Recently, there was a poverty simulation meant to show us what it can be like to live in poverty. There are unexpected challenges, doors that close, difficulty getting help or services, or even a call back. Our panel this hour participated in the simulation. They are deeply concerned about poverty in our community, and I know it opened their eyes. So we're going to talk about what that was, and let me go ahead and introduce the panel. It is a packed studio, and we even have a guest on the phone. In studio is Bill Maley, who is the Brighton supervisor. Bill, nice to see you.
Nice to be here, Evan.
Thanks for being here. Sherry Walker Coart. Sherry Coart Walker. Did I reverse them? It is Walker Coart. I had it right. My email didn't, Sherry. She's the president and CEO of the Center for Dispute Settlement in Rochester. Sherry, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also here is Bill Armbruster, who is the Associate State Director for AARP. Nice to see you.
Glad to be here.
Saul Monero is here, and Saul is the Program Officer for the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Saul, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Hanif Abdul-Wahid is here, who is a community liaison in workforce development for Monroe County. Hanif, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line with us, calling in from Syracuse, is Rhonda O'Connor, who helped coordinate all of this. Rhonda, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
Rhonda, why don't you tell us kind of the origin here and the mission of this kind of a simulation?
Well, the objective of the simulation is to allow individuals to be able to really walk in the shoes of someone who struggles every day with poverty. So it's a really educational experience for those who go through it to really be able to feel it and understand what people go through.
Let me go around the room then, and I'll start with you, Bill. The Brighton Town Supervisor was there, and sometimes, Bill, we talk about poverty as if it is only an urban problem, and we're going to get to that issue a little bit later. But take me through your experience as best you can. What was the day like?
Well, it was an eye-opening experience. We had a period of orientation. Frankly, I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I came into it with some level of anxiety. It was very cold outside. I didn't even know whether we were going to be inside or outside. But they walked us through, and then we spent about an hour and a half of what I would have to say, the word that keeps coming back to me is a very chaotic time simulating the experiences of families who are living in poverty, dealing with various institutions, stores, and the like in their community. And it was a very powerful experience.
Give me one example of something that was eye-opening for you.
Well, the business, the institutions that we were dealing with were certainly from a middle-class suburban background, not the experiences in my normal day. The pawn shop, the social service agencies, those are not institutions. Those are not organizations that many of us in suburban backgrounds have occasion to deal with, and you really get to appreciate the magnitude, the bureaucracy, frankly. As a government official, I was very acutely aware of the bureaucracy that was present in trying to deal on the other side of the desk with these organizations.
Hanif Abdul-Wahid, what was your experience like?
I think it wasn't not so much an eye-opener, but the simulation at least reminded me, and it seemed to be it had more like of a maybe an urban slant to it in terms of how all of the shops were set up and how things were chaotic, as Bill had said. And I think that a lot of people really got an understanding how this agency time that people have to spend daily just to make their life have some type of meaning is very profound.
All right, Saul, as best you can, again, kind of structure the day for me. So we're starting to get a sense for you, dealing with agencies, learning what people in poverty have to deal with. What was the structure of that day like? Give me a little bit more of the background of what the day was like.
Well, I think there are things that folks in poverty deal with that are that were highlighted. And you know, there are things that are on top of everyone else's normal errands, their tasks for the day. You take that, and then you pile on several other things that many folks don't even know are things that have to happen. So in the simulation, I was a child of parents who the father was an alcoholic who had to go to counseling, and my mother was on disability, and she had to go to the health clinic, and then she had to go get vouchers, and she had to and just to get me my medication, she had to go to four different stops. So there were all these layers of activities that were included that people don't even realize are added to a person in that situation's day.
And when you look at it that way, you think, well, she could just not get you the medication. That's one thing that could happen. If she does, it takes all of that time and effort. And then people might be saying, well, why isn't she just trying to get a job or do something else? And you realize what someone's day, all of the burdens that can be there that we probably don't even think about.
And the simulation actually makes you essentially have to make the choice between getting your kids medicine and going to pay the rent or going to apply for a job.
How starkly did that sort of awaken it for you?
You know, as a person who grew up in a single family household, my mother had five kids, and thinking about all the things that she had to do, it reinforced for me just how daunting a task that was for her.
Your mom, a single mom, five kids?
Five kids. I mean, our father was in the picture, but he wasn't involved, like, in the day-to-day things, and, you know, that was how it was back then, you know, and it was really, it just really reinforced, you know, the things that I knew from my own childhood.
You knew it, and then now you're really seeing it. You know, I've said it before, and I will say it again. I'm just so amazed with single parents, I mean, single mothers who make up most of them. I can't imagine that. I mean, my wife and I have one son, and we are doing great. We are fortunate. We have won the life's lottery. I mean, this, in so many ways, my life is easy. And yet, it still can be week to week, day to day. There are certain things that can be difficult. And we have it. It's easy. I can't even imagine. Your own mom. You probably appreciated your mom enough already. But
I do.
I hope you do even more now. That's really remarkable stuff. Bill Armbruster is the Associate State Director for AARP. Bill, for you, highlight something. Tell me about your experience with it.
Well, I think my experience was a little different. I was volunteering at the event. I was a shopkeeper. So you could buy your gas, cash your checks, pay your utility bills. And I went in with this mindset, I'm going to connect with my community. This is going to be awesome. Within the first week, someone came up with a gun, you know, tried to rob me. I was robbed. There were, you know, people passing bad checks. And by the end of the simulation, I was really jaded. I was thinking, wait a minute, my check cashing fees went up. You know, my engagement was, you know, there's a single line, you stand here, you do this. I don't want people, you know, wandering around, taking advantage. And it was really surprising, much more stressful. And watching people throughout the simulation, I think, as the shopkeeper was interesting, because everybody the first week was like, hey, how are you? This is nice. And then they're finding out, oh my gosh, I don't have money to pay my kids. And they'd come in and they wanted gas, and I'd have to send them to the pawn shop because they didn't have enough money. And just watching the stress on people's faces and watching the frenzy of this. And, you know, I think most people have been through a time where things have been maybe tight and you sort of experience that stress. I can't imagine that multiplied and constant.
It sounds to me like it's a reminder that when we think about our community, how come we're not all united? How come we're not all rowing in the same direction? Stress impacts all of us. It impacts business owners. It impacts people's safety. And all of a sudden, it's harder for our community to feel like you're all rowing in the same direction.
Most definitely. And it was interesting because I thought I was aware of who had taken advantage of me, but over the following 2 weeks, I had three more people come up and say, gee, I'm sorry I stole from you. I go, when did you do that?
Oh, wow.
I wasn't even aware of all that was going on. And again, looking for, you know, people looking for jobs, trying to get support. you know, bilingual issues, you know, came up with several folks there, mental health issues in terms of poverty. It was, you know, it's still impactful. I'm still talking about it.
Listeners, I'd love to hear from you, especially if you are dealing with poverty yourself now, you know someone who is, you've been there at some point in your life. What are the things that we take for granted that people in poverty deal with that we're talking about, that the simulation showed, that our panel learned about, that we all should consider? Because, Sherry, I guess the easy thing for all of us is to say, again, that person should just get a job. And I'm not minimizing personal accountability and personal responsibility, but what I am saying is life is a little more complex than just kind of that false dichotomy we create.
Yeah, you asked the
Someone's
question.
Either ambitious or lazy, right?
Excuse me. Yeah, you asked the question, why aren't we all rowing in the same direction? Well, we have different limitations. We were limited in terms of the amount of money. We had an idea of how much money we were going to have, but then things came up that you didn't expect. You didn't have transportation. I played the role of a 20-something-year-old with a young child, which took me back to a tough time, but there was no transportation. On top of that, I had limited English-speaking abilities. And so you were so dependent. And some of the words that we heard in our final circle as we debrief were discouraging and disempowering and all of those kinds of feelings of hopelessness that just you do what you do to make it through that day or that week, just to keep a roof over your head and have some food in the house.
Even if sometimes you're desperate and you have to make a choice that doesn't feel good.
Absolutely. And I found myself compromising because somebody wanted something they were willing to pay for that I found out wasn't so legal, but I was willing to do that. So by the time I got back, we had 20 extra dollars that we hadn't anticipated.
Let me ask, and by the way, our phone number, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, as we talk about poverty, the simulation, and all the challenges that are often hidden for those of us who are fortunate enough not to live in poverty. It's also 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Rhonda, when we hear about these roles that people played in this simulation, we talk about them as abstract concepts, but they're pulled from real life, yes?
Yes, all the families were actually, they were real-life scenarios. So we wanted individuals to really understand and really take part in someone else's life and the tyranny that we call it, that they go through every day.
Rhonda, when it comes to that dichotomy, Sherry and I were just talking about, someone's either ambitious or they're lazy. How dangerous a mindset is that for us to have as a community?
Well, I mean, you really just hit it, because I think, you know, we can work with the individuals as we do here, and we can help change their mindset so that they can become self-sufficient and be able to work in our society built on middle-class norms. But if we don't change the mindset of the people in our community, of the businesses, on what it's like and how poverty affects all of us, then we're still going to come up to those roadblocks. And no matter how much we can help them, if they keep coming up against these barriers, it's just going to push them back another step. So we have to change mindset of everybody.
Well, I see the phone starting to ring, and I was going to get to Gary in Greece, and I see that call was dropped, so let me grab Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. Just a little personal background. I've worked with people who are poor and people with disabilities and other life struggle situations for many years, and some of the things that people have already said, you know, are very important. Of course, the difference is the folks there, I'm assuming, can go back to a more at ease lifestyle and living after the experience that they had, whereas people that we're talking about, it does not really end, at least does not end in any reasonable period of time. So one of the questions I really want to ask, though, is that a lot of this stuff doesn't matter much unless we make some cultural changes, but really political changes, because the lives of these people are affected by the job situation, by education. So my question to the folks would be, after having experienced this, what really progressive, major economic and social political changes, or using the political system, would you now feel either stronger about or embrace initially?
Bonnie, thanks for the question. I'll start with a local elected leader. That's Bill Maley. Any changes you would support after this experience?
Well, it certainly was a moving experience, and the caller is right. The big difference is we went home or we went back to work. It is clear, as I said earlier, you know, you in dealing with bureaucracy, it makes you look at your own bureaucracy as an elected official. I think Hanif and I were talking beforehand, the need for all of us, but particularly for those of us in government, to really internalize and understand that in everything that we do, you know, at the local level, we may not be able to make broad, you know, economic policy changes, but it's important to remember that in the work that we do at the local level, to always be cognizant that these poverty issues are very much present in a suburban setting as well as in an urban setting, and to make sure that we're responding to them.
So you're not necessarily talking about changes in law. You're talking about a government that is more attuned to real-life experience?
That's part of it. Some of it is changes in law. I mean, some of it, you know, even at the local level, to change things to make sure that, you know, people do have the full opportunity to carry on a productive life, but you know that is challenging. The concentration of poverty in the city affects us all. So, for example, making sure we prioritize affordable housing, not just in the city of Rochester. It's important that there be affordable housing throughout the community. That's something we've tried to do with some programs in Brighton.
Frankly, Bill, we've had a conversation on this program earlier this month after the newest poverty report. And if we only talk about affordable housing in urban settings, that's how we kind of push people into one small community. We concentrate poverty and we probably make it worse for everybody. I mean, that was one of the conclusions the report is drawing. Do you agree with that, Bill?
Oh, I think that's true. Poverty, the concentration of poverty. You know, we've in Brighton, we certainly do have poverty. You know, an example is that our Brighton food cupboard, when it opened a few years back, immediately began doing 3 and 4 times the amount of business, the number of users, than they ever expected. So that's a direct presence of poverty in Brighton. But we are all affected by this concentration of poverty in the city, the spin-off effects, whether it's employment, whether it's crime, certainly housing. And because we're all affected, all of us in local government have a responsibility to be part of the solution.
Okay, and one more follow-up for Bill, and then we'll kick it back to the rest of the panel. To some degree, I'm not speaking I'm trying not to generalize too much about people who live in the suburbs, governments in the suburbs, et cetera. But if the view is, hey, I live in the suburb because I chose not to live in the city, I didn't want city problems, et cetera. We hear that sometimes. We heard it recently in Spencerport when we talk about urban-suburban programs, et cetera. There has to be, you're talking about a willingness to take on a more diverse community when some of your voters might not want it, some of your taxpayers may not want it. I mean, how do you start to do that in the suburbs to say we're willing to see more of a diversity of housing, we don't want it just concentrated in the city? What's that going to take?
Well, we're fortunate, I have to say, in Brighton, because we are a relatively more diverse community in many ways, not just racially, but faiths, socioeconomic. We have very high-end housing, absolutely, but we also do have starter homes, affordable homes. But that's something we can't just passively sit by and let happen. I believe we have to be aggressively out there, whether it's affordable housing, transit. We want to make sure that people are connected. You know, if jobs aren't in the city, if jobs are out in the suburban areas, we have an obligation to make sure we're working with our GRTA and other agencies to get people to the jobs.
All right, the phones are on fire. Before I get back to the phones, let me ask the rest of the panel. You heard Bonnie's question on would you support, after this experience, any changes beyond the notion of having an understanding of what it's like? Would you support actual changes in law or policy, et cetera? Anybody want to weigh in on that? Let me ask Bill Armbruster, the Associate State Director of AARP.
Well, my hope is this isn't a one-time simulation, that we do take this around the community, around the county, to different folks. and have this experience, because I think we do need to change that lazy or, you know, people who are out, you know, movers and shakers kind of thing. There is the in-between. I think unless we change some perceptions and start the right dialogue, we're going to have some difficulty moving this forward. So this truly should be a community conversation as a whole. And again, my hope is that we're able to take the simulation, you know, throughout wherever anybody wants it.
Rhonda, is there are there plans to do this elsewhere or more often?
Yes, actually, I have been getting some phone calls and to come back and do some other simulations within the different counties in Rochester and in Buffalo.
Okay, and I want to make sure I give the proper credit. I know ACT Rochester, the host was ACT Rochester, yes? I mean,
yes.
I don't know how many total organizations, because I know our panel comes from diverse backgrounds, but ACT Rochester and the folks who went through this have been raving about that. So let me go ahead and get back to the phones, because I want to keep the conversation going, and the phones are all lit up here. And this is Gary in Greece. Go ahead, Gary.
Hi, Evan. And a great panel, good discussion. I think, unfortunately, I got dropped, so I may have missed some of the discussion, but I so much appreciate that people are addressing the challenge that we face here, that, you know, we live in a society based on a Puritan work ethic where wealth is reflective of personal character. And it's good to hear people talk about the interconnectedness of all people. I live in the Spencerport School District in the town of Greece, and you can see where, you know, that old ethic plays in. You know, we know about Spencerport. Recently, we had the town supervisor talk about turning Greece into Mayberry, which is fine, but the problem with Mayberry is that only works when everyone is the same. And I'm wondering if your guests could also comment on how we get past the political rhetoric that somehow helping the poor is socialism and some kind of unconstitutional redistribution of wealth. Thank you.
Gary, thank you. Yeah, go ahead. Let me kick it over to Hanif Abdul-Wahid, who, again, is a community liaison in workforce development for Monroe County. Go ahead, Hanif.
Yeah, and that premise that the caller just stated, I mean, that's almost a world view. Most of the world citizens are in poverty. So when we speak about the issue of poverty and its effect on it and stuff, of that nature, we have to look at it to where we're able to put our hands around it. And so locally, when we're discussing poverty, yeah, there's poverty in the suburbs and there's poverty in the city of Rochester, and it's all equally gonna impact us or affect us in ways that you can somewhat see based upon the simulation. One observation I had with the simulation is that we were there, we went through the simulation, and there was nothing in the simulation to say, how do you get out? And so this is the thing that I think should come about in terms of what do we think is the best way to get out of poverty. I know a lot of people say we might have to have a better city school district. So far, the city school district in the city of Rochester is failing by almost all accounts. So if that's the case, maybe we have to do something else. But I think we have to identify what poverty basically is for certain demographics. The report that ACT Rochester did is that in 1990, 14 of the census tracts, they were 40% below the poverty line, and now today the census tracts is 27 census tracts that show the same thing. So it's just basically growing. We haven't developed any way to say that we're going to come together and try to get out of this mess, and I think it's a regional type of a strategy that has to take place.
The host is not here to share. I'm here to help facilitate discussion. I will say we've talked a lot about education on this program the last year, and there are some very compelling arguments that I've seen that indicate you can definitely work to improve schools, and we always should be doing mm-hmm. that. But if you alleviate poverty, you're going to see the schools get better instantly, even if you made no change in the schools. So, but I think to Hanif's point, let me just ask Rhonda real briefly. there was no simulation part that says, how do you get out of this? And maybe that wasn't the purpose of it, Rhonda, but can you address that?
Sure. One of the things I like to do when we debrief is actually talk about what changes can be made and what changes can be made on the personal level, throughout the agencies, maybe systemic level, policy levels, and, you know, your community level. And I realize that when people leave the simulation, that they think about it for a week or so, and then they get busy with their life, and it doesn't go anywhere. And it's really important to have next steps set up within your community to keep it going. But one thing people really have to remember is that everybody needs to be at the table. So when you're talking about solutions, every race, every ethnic background, the individuals from poverty are the most important people that need to be at the table, because those are the ones that are living it every day, and those are the ones to be able to tell us what their barriers are that are holding them back. And then we could begin to develop the programs and change the systemic issues or policy issues.
Saul Monero is the program officer for the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Saul, I just wanted to ask you real briefly, and you can pull that microphone over. This is a packed studio here, and it's a packed hour with phone calls. Saul, I just wanted to ask you to follow up to Gary's comment. Again, you grew up with a single mom and four other siblings, and I suspect you reject the notion that poverty is a reflection of character.
I would wholly disagree. I think it's important that opportunities be presented to people who are in poverty. And, you know, I was one of the few of friends who I grew up going to school with who had the opportunities that I did. And, you know, part of it was, you know, I had teachers who recognized my potential. You know, I was more a little bit of a diamond in the rough, but, you know, the teachers that I did have, they recognized my potential, and they saw that I was willing to work. And it wasn't that my fellow classmates weren't. It was a question of them only being able to focus their energy on a handful of the kids because there were so many issues. So I feel like, you know, there could have been five different kids that I grew up with that if you know, those same teachers could have spent that amount of energy on those other five kids, mm-hmm. versus the five kids they had the time for, then there would have been 10 kids who came out of this group of kids I went all through elementary and middle school with.
And Evan, just to make a point, this is situation poverty and generational poverty. They're basically different animals. I know the panacea is that if we have jobs and stuff like that, then it's going to somewhat go away. And I just don't see it that way.
I've got to get a 60-second break in, and then we're coming back, and the phone lines are going to dominate the rest of the hour. So Tim in Pittsford, Joan in Irondequoit, Ben in Rochester, Bill in Webster, and more. Your phone calls are coming up here on member-supported public radio as we talk about poverty in our community next. Welcome back, and my colleague Helen Biondutti Hofer is going to continue this kind of discussion and conversation tonight. Need to Know at 8 p.m. on WXXI-TV, host Helen Biondutti Hofer examines, first of all, how the home of Susan B. Anthony, one of America's first boom towns, and an area rich in colleges and universities, arts, and more, has become synonymous with poverty. From a Rochester resident who shares her personal story of the struggle in pursuing the American dream to area leaders sharing their response to Rochester's poverty crisis, you want to tune into an in-depth look at the issue tonight, 8 o'clock, WXXI-TV, channel 21.1 or cable 11 or 1221. With Helene and the great work there, and they're going to continue this conversation. Let me go ahead and get back to the phones, and next up is Tim in Pittsford. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan, a couple comments and one question. I'll go as quick as I can. I grew up middle class. I think as a kid, most of the time you don't realize it, but I've heard, you know, equating hard work and money in it. I mean, that's great if it happens, but I remember my dad going to work when it was dark out, getting home when it was dark out. He owned his own small business, made sure he paid his employees, gave them time off. But there was weeks where he didn't bring home a paycheck. And he was, I don't remember him being lazy. I mean, going to work for 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a day it doesn't seem lazy to me. And so I'm kind of tired of hearing that from some people. I'm kind of along the same lines. Those same people say, well, welfare, these people are living so great off welfare. I work in the roughest parts of the city, and poverty-wise, probably some of the worst in the country. And then it's not like I'm walking in and out of those houses saying, oh, my God, they've got a 50-inch TV. Man, they're just set for life. It's not like they're going to be retiring at 55 with a pension or anything. I mean, that argument's ridiculous to me as well. And the other thing about poverty in the city, and I don't know, maybe it's taboo to even bring this up, but for women under the age of 30, the out-of-wedlock birth rate is somewhere around 50% now. And yet, if that woman gets married to the father of the child, it's some sort of magic pill where, I mean, you could still be in poverty, but the rate is just not even remotely close to what it is. And it doesn't seem to get brought up much. And it doesn't matter to me, in all honesty, why people get married. If it works, it works. I don't care if you believe in God or you don't believe in God or however you get married, but for some reason, that just seems to, I guess bring a family closer together and good values and work there. But I rarely ever hear it in the conversation.
Tim, thanks very much for the call. And I think, first of all, his point, if you are young, single, and you have a child, your chances of ending up in poverty are certainly higher. I mean, there's no doubt about that, right? I mean, I don't think there's any questioning about that. No. Sherry, should we talk more about that in this
community? Yeah, I guess I'm not so sure. I was a young single parent. I had graduated from college and done that kind of thing. So I don't know that you automatically end up...
It's not automatic, right? But
in poverty, but I think... Yeah. Well, I think there's other factors to consider, whether they've finished their education or not, whether they have support systems. I think to just make a blanket statement like that, I feel, is a little out of balance. And so, yeah, we want to have families, however people define them, but we're redefining families, too. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in my simulation, again, I was a 20-something-year-old married... a person with a new baby still in an impoverished situation, part of it because I didn't speak the language, part of it because we were new, we didn't have job experience, and so the jobs we got were, or the family got were entry-level positions, and you can't make a living for four people on that kind of thing. So I don't know that I would resonate with that.
Okay, and I'm trying to connect a number of threads here in my own mind from conversations in the past year. Planned Parenthood has told me that that certainly they have plenty of suburban middle-class people, women coming in who need abortion, but often it is impoverished women who don't have access to birth control, who need abortion, who come in for them for services. So usually it's impoverished or uneducated. And I think to Sherry's point, you could be young and single and have a child, and if you have a support system and if you have an education, you could be okay. But more of the people who are having children who are young and single don't have those things.
Okay.
So you're saying it's not just having a child. There's a lot of other factors.
There's other factors and the opportunity that was mentioned earlier. So making sure that people have the same opportunities is crucial.
So it's about creating opportunities, I think.
And there's the scold part of it that the... that you hear in the society more so than you're going to educate yourself to what maybe are the real issues of why people somewhat stay generation in poverty versus situational poverty. So we have these scolding things about having babies and things like that. Then to really look at maybe some of the issues of economic downturn and some of the systems in school and home and culture and stuff like that.
Let me get back to the phones and Ben in Rochester. Go ahead, Ben.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to talk a little bit about, well, first of all, thank you for having this conversation.
Sure.
I feel like it's not spoken enough nearly. It's really, really rare that I hear a conversation about poverty, maybe because it's depressing to people, but it's much more depressing for people that are living in it, that's for sure. I want to mention that I feel like a lot of our political systems are derived from philosophy, and there's a man named Herbert Spencer who interpreted Darwin, and he brought forth the term survival of the fittest and social Darwinism. It actually wasn't originally in the book that he wrote, that Darwin wrote. And that kind of led towards this Ayn Rand point of view that selfishness is evil, and that, or I'm sorry, selfishness is a virtue, and altruism is evil. And I think we need to dismiss that notion. There's another book that was less well-known and not as popular in capitalist societies, written by Peter Kropotkin, that talks about mutual aid in evolution and how the species that have actually survived the longest on the planet were species that embraced mutual aid as well as competition. And this idea of a self-made man or pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, it really isn't relevant when you look at it in from a scientific point of view. If you look at Utah recently, they've been giving homes to homeless people, just straight giving them to them. They've been assigning social workers to them. And they found out that costs a lot less money than dealing with the homeless problem in a cliche way. So I'm wondering if anybody considers possibly embracing that idea in Rochester, or if that's something that people are maybe want to embrace. It makes sense to me.
Providing homes, giving houses, you're saying.
Yeah, providing homes, because they've cut down on homelessness about 74% in the past 8 years, which is incredibly impressive to me. And it's costing the city less money by just housing people, because if you don't have a home to shower, then you're not going to be able to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, because you can't get a job if you can't shower, and it leads to a whole bunch of other problems that can also induce mental illness and or worse.
Ben, thanks for
the programs that support these.
Yeah, Ben, thanks for the call. A lot to think about, and I confess I'm not familiar with the specifics he's talking about out in Utah. But anybody on this panel want to weigh in on the question of housing and providing housing? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I don't know about the Utah issue, but in Portland, Oregon, right now, what they're experimenting with is the micro homes. So they're placing homeless people in these, they're like 400 square foot homes, and giving them the opportunity to actually own those homes. So they're small, but you know, it's a place to call their own, and it's modeled after a couple of European models that have proven to significantly reduce homelessness, and for the folks that were either below the poverty level or what we might call working poor, they were able to elevate their income status up to a much more comfortable lifestyle.
Self-sustaining.
For themselves.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
That's Portland, you said?
In Portland, Oregon.
Okay, and I think what you have in this kind of conversation is you get the cartoonish version and then you get the reality that's a lot murkier. The cartoonish version is that people on the right would say you can't give someone housing because that creates a moral hazard, and then poor people know that they don't have to work to get a house, and it snowballs. And on the left, you have the cartoonish version would say, well, liberals just want to give people houses for nothing. When the reality is somewhere in the middle, that there will be some people who do try to take it for granted, and there will be many other people who use it apparently in the way Saul is talking about in Portland help them. And I don't know which side the scale it goes on, but it's not one or the other.
And Evan, I'm not familiar with that Utah program either, but there's certainly some similarities to what Habitat for Humanity is doing, where the participants are not given homes. They work for their homes. There's sweat equity. Now, that program isn't 100%, you know, no program is going to have a 100% success rate. But it is being actively pursued on the west side of Rochester. In Brighton, one of the things we've tried to do, and I think it's important, all too often affordable housing becomes stigmatized. It's there. It's in a big block. Everybody, the project, to speak in sort of the colloquial terms. affordable housing doesn't have to be done in one big project. And by doing it in a way that it is part of a larger residential community, whether single family or multifamily, can be a way, even if it's not owner-occupied property, of being a good stepping stone, getting it out beyond that concentrated urban core, and giving people those broader opportunities that are there. But if you're living out of the back seat of a car, the future is you can't even think about the concept of finding a way out. You're just hoping to find a way to wake up the next day.
So you're agreeing with Ben's point there that if we don't address housing, all these other things can spiral out of that.
Absolutely.
But I think we can broaden it. I think it was Rhonda who said it. It just resonated with me at that session. She said, we either can continue serving people and keeping them in their same conditions, or we can alter the landscape and mitigate their condition. And that doesn't just mean housing, but what can we do to make things change a little bit so that people can at least see that there's a way out? Mm-hmm. So whether it's housing or jobs or education, it's all of those things. So what do we do to not keep people in those conditions, but help them do something different for their lives?
And I think there's a distinction between giving someone an opportunity and giving someone a handout. And we, I think we have to move into models that are primarily opportunity-based.
Well, if you're just joining us, before I get back to the phones, which continue to ring this hour, we're talking about a recent poverty simulation, and all of our participants who come from sort of a wide range of backgrounds in our community participated in that poverty simulation that ACT Rochester hosted. Bill Maley, the Brighton supervisor, Sherry Walker-Coard, who's the president and CEO of the Center for Dispute Settlement. Saul Monero is a program officer for the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Bill Armbruster is the associate state director for AARP. Hanif Abdul-Wahid is a community liaison in workforce development for Monroe County. And Rhonda O'Connor, before I go back to the phones, who's on the line with us from Syracuse and who coordinated here, a lot of talk about housing. We're hearing it from our listeners. We're hearing it on this panel. When you put these kind of simulations together, how do you address housing?
You know, that's housing is always, it used to be where people were, you know, treat the person first and get them stable and then get them housing. And now the thought process is changing where put them in housing so they have a place to stay and a roof over the head and then treat them. So it keeps going back and forth. But I can say living in poverty is obviously housing is important. But, you know, there's a lot of issues that affect poverty, and you have to be able to look at each person holistically, each person one-on-one, to find out and figure out what it is that that person actually needs. And when they are stuck in the cycle, and that's what happens when they're stuck in our, especially the welfare cycle, they feel like there's absolutely no end out of it. And sometimes that's exactly what happens, and they need that little bit of help and understanding that there is a way out and we can help you. But that being said, there has been many times when we've really had to advocate for individuals because they get stuck in the welfare system, and all of a sudden they come up to what we call the cliff effect, and they choose between, is it easier for me just to get back on welfare, or is it, or do I keep this job and really struggle even worse when I was on my benefits?
All right, let me get back to the phones. This is Bill in Webster who's been waiting. Bill, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead.
Thank you. Kudos to yourself and the panel. I've spent many hours on your program with your predecessor, Bob Smith, as the welfare director for Monroe County. Mm. I started in the 60s as a community organizer at Baden Street with people like Jim McCullough and Franklin Flores. And up until recently, some years ago, I retired as the welfare director, appointed by Lucien Moore and retired under Jack Doyle. My comment is that we should take off the shelves, because all your comments are very good. Poverty is pretty, you know, like a stained glass window, many faceted. The No Time to Lose that we worked with in the 80s with Mario Cuomo, which resulted in the Child Assistance Program in Monroe County, the different school initiatives we did with Tom Fry, the various things we did with Lucian Morin and Tom Ryan at the city and the Center for Governmental Research on Housing. And we should look at all of those, because as a welfare director, probably the youngest at 33 until I retired in the late 90s, I've worked with most people either at the local or state or federal level, going back to the Nixon initiatives right up through some of our current presidents. But my question for the panel, therefore, is one of the things that we don't really seem to deal with, you've dealt with it a little bit on some of your programs, like down from Atlanta, Georgia, etc., is until we can take our children, the high incidence of poverty children in the city, and move them and integrate them into schools with others like they do in some other states successfully, until we can take the plantations we have in the city of Rochester and take the people there for housing and move them and integrate them into the community like we attempted to do years ago with Phillips Village and a little bit with Gananda, which didn't make it, and some of the other new towns. My question to the panel, do they think we can really address poverty in a real meaningful systemic way until we start getting at some of those real barriers?
Thanks for the call, Bill. We'll go around the room.
Well, I think we have to address it in a systematic and because it is a systemic problem. One of the things we were talking about off air is, and one of the things that came out to so many of us through the simulation, is that so many of the agencies it's a very siloed system. You have one silo for this and one silo for that. The analogy to a Wegmans grocery store where you can go in and address a wide variety of needs, that's a big part of the problem, and a big part of why our experience in this simulation was such a chaotic, almost a Lord of the Flies-like scenario, where you saw people really begin to take advantage of anything they could get their hands on, because there were so many different pressure points, it wasn't possible to deal with all of them and address all of your concerns, because each silo had a different need, and if you didn't know the right place to go, you had to go back to the back of the line at the next stop, and you may not still be in the right place.
Anybody else want to tackle that? Go ahead, Sherry.
I guess I have to go back to the generational poverty. I think we have to be realistic. I was remembering the race exhibit that came here a couple of years ago, and one of the areas that was just very profound to a number of people was the area that talked about the GI Bill, that whether you were African American or white or whatever, you got the GI Bill. But those who were African American who got the GI Bill were directed to one part of the city that would not appreciate. And those who were not were directed to another part where their homes would appreciate, which is where the middle class really, really, really began to grow. So I think it's multifaceted and complicated when we talk about getting rid of poverty. It's more than putting people in houses and giving them food. It's a mindset that I think takes some time. And it's a mindset from those of us who provide services, that we don't get jaded, that we provide the best service to everybody, that we treat everybody with dignity and respect in a way that helps empower them.
That exhibit really brought home to me that the decisions we make today resonate for years and generations to come. That was the visual impact of that exhibit, and the pile of money so much higher for those the white GIs that had gone out to Levittown, I think it was, out on Long Island, and how that multiplier effect over time, those decisions dramatically impacted not only those soldiers but their children and generations to come.
Let me just follow up on one quick point that Sherry raises here, showing dignity, respect, not getting jaded, not getting frustrated. We've seen a conversation about how to help homelessness in this community, and there's been a bit of a divide in terms of approach and what's appropriate, and certainly we've seen with Sister Grace and the House of Mercy essentially saying we have to find a way to help folks, even if they have been in this cycle for a long time. We've talked about this cycle. And that you get used to being homeless and you find a way to survive with it. People are survivalists. We saw the Glazers step up and try to help create an indoor winter solution. I believe on Canal Street, I believe they've done that. There's going to hopefully be a permanent solution. But early in those days after even the Canal Street building opens, some of the people who are homeless, who are used to be living in what they called Sanctuary Village, were choosing not to show up and take it. And some people, cynically, I saw it on social media saying, well, look, they don't want their homelessness cured. They don't want help. That's what they want. They want to, you know, the cynical view was they want to do their drugs and live their life the way they've figured out how to do, and they're not interested in help. And maybe that's what we're talking about, Sherry, is not to get jaded, not to know that the change doesn't come overnight with this, that there's a lot of work that has to be done in helping people emerge from this system that they've learned how to survive in. Is that?
Yeah, and giving them choices and opportunity. I mean, we can either force people into it and say, you know, feel empowered, but we're giving you the power, or give them the opportunity. If people choose not to participate in something, then we have at least have provided an opportunity for them to take. But to not provide it, I think, is worse.
And I think Sister Grace will tell you, okay, they're not showing up that first night. She's going to go after them. She's going to try to get them the second night. She's not going to give up. We've got people in this community who are not going to give up.
Yeah, but Evan, that's a very small
demographic
to pull from to make the analogy. But once again, I would think that the community of Rochester has to, in the surrounding region, has to come to the point that we're talking about this issue. And we had it in the simulation and everything. I'll go back to the question, how does someone get out of poverty? I think that is the thing that we must discuss. And I think people would be willing to step up and possibly follow those instructions or directions if we can do that. But I think what tends to happen a lot of time, this blame game keeps us from coming to the table to really realize the great opportunity and potential it is to solve this here in the city of Rochester.
Well, that's a great way to finish the conversation. I think we lost Rhonda, but let me just thank the panel who is in studio. Thanks to Rhonda as well. The phone never stopped ringing. The interest in this community continues on this issue, and we're not done talking about it. We barely scratched the surface, but thanks to everyone for being here. Thanks for your participation in the conversation. Thanks to all our listeners. If you couldn't get through, we're going to have a different kind of a prong of the poverty discussion tomorrow. Children and women, especially in abuse situations. We talk about that tomorrow. Join the conversation Friday on Connections. Have a great Thursday.